morning, Your Honors. I am Attorney David Sutterfield, and I represent Mr. Frost, as it may please the Court and Counsel. The lack of substantial justification in this EJIA case is beyond question. Included in the word substantial, one of the roots is substance. And the fact that the Social Security Administration has had to resort to ad hoc arguments in the lower court and before this court, and to some extent certain degree of fantasy, indicates that there's substantial substance lacking in its position. I think a bigger question really is, how did this case come this far on this question? In part of these cases, we do look at the pre-litigation conduct of the government, which in this instance we'd start with the ALJ's decision, and we look at the decision with respect to Mr. Frost's mental health treatment, and we're talking nearly 2 years of treatment encompassing 135 pages of record, and ALJ's single-sentence statement with regard to those records leaves the reviewer clueless as to how long Mr. Frost is under treatment, how often he went for treatment, whether he received counseling services, whether individual, group, whether he received psychiatric care, what kind of medications he took, what other sorts, whether those medications were changed, increased, decreased, what his beginning prognosis was and functional status was, what his status was at the time of the hearing or the decision. I don't know any regulation, any Social Security ruling, or any case law that would permit that sort of analysis, because that is an analysis. It's just a total abrogation of the ALJ's decision. So in terms of how do we get this far, when I file a complaint and then a motion with a supporting brief, and that hits the desk of the receiving attorney, I would think that they might look at that and say, you know what, this decision just doesn't comport with the regulations, the rulings, and the law, and let's go ahead and dispose of it. But that didn't happen. We had to go through all of the briefing. The magistrate had to issue a decision. The decision found that, again, the ALJ had ignored an entire line of evidence, didn't even address my questions with regard to the physical complaints, and also found that the decision was not supported by substantial evidence. You know, again, as the court is aware, that's a pebble on a sidewalk. You know, gee, did that cause the person to trip or not? It's a very minimal standard. When a magistrate sends a case back for that on that basis, that's an indication that if it doesn't meet substantial evidence test, then it probably also there's not substantial justification for fighting the claim. I also have some serious concerns with regard to I think the magistrate's decision with regard to the credibility of Mr. Frost is erroneous in view of the fact that we have an entire line of evidence missing, and the Moss v. Astru case makes it very clear that we have to consider treatment. But I think that the underlying decision by the magistrate is basically that's the second big bang that should go off and alert the government that, hey, we need to put a stop to this. But they didn't. Instead, when I filed the EJIA application, they contested that. And they contested in a manner that's inappropriate. They raised ad hoc arguments. That's not appropriate. They couldn't raise them before the magistrate. The magistrate, in fact, when they did so,
said ad hoc arguments just sounds like a description of most legal arguments. That is, they're case specific.
Well, it's the terminology used in the case law and by the magistrate in this particular case, and what it means is that the ALJ didn't make the argument, and the commissioner did after the fact. That's not how we decide these cases, and that is, in fact, why the case is there's lack of substantial justification for the government's position.
It sounds like your brief said that every time a Social Security disability decision is remanded, there have to be attorney's fees because you wouldn't get a remand unless there was some serious error. And of course, that's not this circuit's view, certainly not what we said a couple of weeks ago in Thuvenot, Wade, and Morriston.
Oh, I agree with you that not every case. This is egregious when...
Is your position compatible with our decision in Thubineau, Wade, and Morrison?
It's compatible from the standpoint that this decision is vacuous. This decision is tantamount to the ALJ simply having put claim denied. There's no articulation whatsoever or analysis of the decision.
That's concretely how it's compatible with our decision in Thubineau, Wade, and Morrison.
In Guno, Wade, and Morrison, there was some discussion of the evidence. In this particular case, there was virtually none. And I think that's why it's not substantial evidence. When people go to these hearings, they go to these hearings for a purpose, to have the evidence reviewed and considered, and it didn't occur.
Are you trying to say that some issues were raised for the first time at some level of appeal and weren't before the first decision maker? I wasn't quite clear of that.
Certainly. In the commissioner's brief before the magistrate and in its brief before this court, they went to argue what is in the record in terms of the mental health treatment records. That's the administrative law judge's job. He's the one who weighs the evidence. You don't go to the court and ask the court to reweigh the evidence and put forth arguments that the ALJ didn't make in his decision for the first time. It's not a new case when it comes to the district court. It's what happened in the previous case and what was the analysis done there. So it would be totally inappropriate to commence an entire new presentation of the evidence, an entire new analysis the administrative law judge never engaged in. And that's what occurred. And that's one of the reasons that the magistrate did, in fact, reverse the case.
But he said that with what the government's case is substantially justified, therefore the attorney's fees aren't available.
Right. He said that in the second decision. There's
right.
Two decisions.
Right.
And in the second decision, he said that, and he also accepted part of the ad hoc arguments that he had earlier rejected in the underlying case. And that would eviscerate EJA. If you allow for that, in terms of, well, you can't come in here and defend an administrative law judge's decision and make arguments and cite facts that the administrative law judge never considered because we're not going to reweigh the evidence, and then come along and say, oh, well, we were substantially justified in bringing this case for this, and this reason that's in the record, when that's not the issue. When you look at these cases, you look at them from the administrative get-go. And what did the judge do? So in that instance, the judge totally ignored all of the treatment records. Again, you have no idea from reviewing that decision whether he received one counseling session or 200 counseling sessions. You have no idea if he saw a psychiatrist one time or every other day. You have no idea what kind of medication he was taking. Was it something that it's routinely prescribed for people who work every day, or is it something that's prescribed for people who have significant mental health disorders? And was that medication changed? Was it changed and titrated upward? No clue whatsoever. And that's why the position can't be justified. When it hit the desk of the reviewing attorney, he said, geez, why would I take this case and argue a brief in front of a district court that the magistrate's decision should be upheld? We wouldn't. And that goes to the heart of lack of substantial justification. Any other questions on that?
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Carlson.
May it please the court, counsel, assistant regional counsel Patrick Carlson for the appellee, the Commissioner of Social Security. Your Honor, the question in this case is whether the district court acted within its discretion in finding the commissioner's defense of the ALJ's decision to be substantially justified, and whether accordingly an award of EJA fees was appropriately denied.
Why, if there's such a record here of mental health treatment, a couple of years, 130 some pages of reports, would a one sentence dusting off of that claim that all that evidence be justified.
Well, Your Honor, and we recognize that the district court remanded for further, and the quote word used by the district court was explanation of the assessment of that evidence. But we note that the ALJ did provide, it was one sentence, but it was a sentence that directly cited evidence within the record, and within those notes. The ALJ said, and I quote here, recent treatment notes show that he, Mr. Frost, has been improving and is more involved now with hobbies. He has made good progress in symptom management and coping goals. That phrase, good progress in symptom management and coping goals, is highly relevant because that's a direct quote of an entry by Dr. Levine in the treatment notes showing that he had been making progress. Similarly,
The difference here is if you're trying a case to a jury gets to say guilty or not guilty without any reasons or what have you. But if you're trying a case to a court, a judge has to articulate some reasons. So we expect the judge to issue findings of fact and conclusions of law as to why he made a certain finding. And it just seems pretty Spartan record here for 2 years of treatment to just dust it off as it was here.
Well, Your Honor, and of course, Mr. Satterfield does not make any statement that this sentence itself is in any way inaccurate, and he can't because it's a direct quotation and directly sifted from the treatment notes in question. So the question becomes whether the other evidence in that 135 pages contains something relevant to Mr. Frost's ability to perform work in the region. And while there are 135 pages, the suggestion that each and every one of those 135 pages contains relevant evidence that needs to be addressed specifically is not correct. Many of the early notes reflect Mr. Frost's couples counseling with social worker Jennifer Williams because he and his girlfriend fight a lot and are involved in name-calling. That evidence does not need to be addressed by the ALJ because it does not reflect the Mr. Frost's ability to work. Similarly, note entries in those notes, and the notes are replete with them, about an entry is made because somebody missed an appointment or a cancellation needs to be made. This doesn't need to be incorporated. What does need to be incorporated is any relevant evidence. And the district court identified one piece of evidence that it found to be so relevant, and that is Dr. Moorer's increase of plaintiff's Wellbutrin dosage in 2007. She doubled it. And the district court said there is evidence supporting the ALJ's determination on this issue, but because he didn't articulate the evidence so clearly, I, as a court of review, can't meaningfully review the decision to make sure whether the determination, whether the ALJ appropriately reconciled the information together. And for that reason, I have to remand it for the ALJ to explain his reasoning better. But a remand for a basis of a further explanation is simply an articulation problem. And when you have an articulation problem, this implicates this court's line of reasoning in Stein and Cunningham, and actually this court's recent decision in the Greaves case in January, where if an ALJ addresses evidence but does not do so sufficiently clearly for the reviewing court's satisfaction, a remand may be inappropriate, but the agency is substantially justified in defending the decision, and an award of EJF fees, a denial of EJF fees, is within the district court's discretion.
From your standpoint, what is the ALJ expected to do on remand?
The ALJ is going to have to reconcile, and I'm glad you asked that, Your Honor, because part of the reason that these treatment notes are relevant is the ALJ recognized that Dr. Levine's opinion was inconsistent with them. The ALJ is going to have to explain why his assessment that these treatment notes show an improvement in Mr. Frost's condition, his activity relating to hobbies and how it renders his statements that he can't do anything incredible, and explain.
Several times the ALJ is going to have to do X or Y. Why hasn't that happened already?
Your Honor, I don't know what the ALJ was thinking when he decided to identify the information he included into the the record into his decision and what amount of discussion he believed was appropriate. Certainly in each case...
Now, you're not getting my question. Why hasn't the ALJ finished his job already? The remand took place quite some time ago. After the remand, the magistrate judge is asked to award attorney's fees and decides that. And then the case is fully briefed and argued in the Seventh Circuit. What's wrong with an administrative law judge not to be able to decide this case on remand?
Your Honor, I have no knowledge from the record or personally with the status of the case.
Oh, so you don't know whether it may already have happened.
Your Honor, and I'm hesitant to make a commitment because I do know in many cases when a remand occurs, if a claimant has made a subsequent application for benefits, the cases may and often are consolidated so that the period goes from the starting date in the first application to the ending in the second one. Did that happen here? I don't know. So I'm not able to speculate. But sometimes on a remand, the case becomes a larger case than was originally before the district court judge.
Or it becomes resolved.
Or it becomes resolved.
I mean, for all we know, he went back and looked at something and decided he's disabled or something. And administrative. And obviously that's not going to be appealed.
Well, Mr. Sutterfield ought to know what's happened to
you
the
hope.
Case. I would think.
So, proceeding, the ALJ, and we note that the district court remanded on three bases. That Mr. Frost challenged the ALJ's decision on three bases: the failure to articulate his consideration of the mental health treatment notes, the assessment of Dr. Levine's opinion, and the credibility determination. The district court affirmed the credibility determination, but remanded on the other two bases. But in both cases where the district court remanded for the express purpose to allow the ALJ to explain his reasoning, not to consider additional evidence, but to explain his assessment of evidence that he, at least to some extent, did explain in the original decision. But that brings us back to an articulation problem, whether the ALJ simply did not explain himself clearly enough for meaningful review. And in those situations, under Stein and under Cunningham, the district court acts well within its discretion in denying EJA fees. We note that the ALJ did identify evidence in assessing Dr. Levine's opinion. He noted that Dr. Levine noted factors that aren't traditionally part of a treating psychologist's opinion, and that combined with a comparison of the opinion to the treatment notes rendered his opinion not particularly probative. Similarly, the ALJ looked at the record and determined that plaintiff's credibility was not, that his statements about the extent of his limitations were not fully credible. Your Honor, ultimately, the district court recognized correctly.
By the way, what does the statement that a claimant is not fully credible mean? It sounds like fudge.
Your Honor, the ALJ is charged with determining whether the plaintiff's description of his symptoms and impairments
of course.
Is
so
fully...
the administrative law judge could find that statement A was credible and statement B was not credible.
Right.
But when an administrative law judge just says in blank, the claimant was not wholly credible or some variation, it's, well, useless is one word that comes to mind.
Well,
was there any place where the ALJ explained what was honest and what was dishonest?
Well, and I hesitate to use the words honest and dishonest. It's couched more in terms of accuracy.
Credible means.
Right.
Right?
Well,
honest mistakes are not a credibility problem.
Right.
Intentional lies, that is, perjury, that's a credibility problem.
It could also be...
Don't quibble.
I will not quibble, Your Honor. But
if
on
you would answer my question, I would appreciate it.
On page 19, the ALJ addressed a number of factors relating to Mr. Frost's statements about both his physical and mental impairments. He compared those statements with the evidence provided in the medical record, including, as I said, not just the mental health records, but the physical records, because he complained about his physical condition, determined that Mr. Frost's statements as to the extent and limitations of those impairments were not accurate. Your Honor, I see my time is up.
Thank you, counsel.
And we'd ask that the district court's decision be affirmed. Thank you, Your Honors.
Anything further, Mr. Sutterfield?
Again, I'm rather taken aback by, again, the inaccuracies of counsel's arguments. There is no comparison of Mr. Frost's credibility to findings in a record. That's why we're here. That's why the case was remanded, because the ALJ ignored an entire line of evidence.
What has happened on remand, Mr. Sutterfield?
Still pending Mr. Frost's award of disability benefits on a new application with an onset date the day after this decision was issued on the ALJ's decision, based on his mental impairment. The Peoria office is a very slow office. It's ranked 139th out of 146 in the country in terms of its speed of processing cases. So that's where it's happened. It's in a...
So nothing's happened? I missed exactly what you said.
We have this claim that has been remanded to the Peoria office. We have a claim that Mr. Frost filed when he got the unfavorable decision that was immediately granted and determined he became disabled the day after the decision based on his mental health. I don't want to. I know the court has a lot of other things to do today, but I just thank you.
The case will be taken under advisement.